You shall have no other gods before me. Okay, that phrase. It's probably the most famous line from the Ten Commandments, wouldn't you say?
Oh, easily. Everyone knows it.
But really, think about it. What did that even mean thousands of years ago? I mean, in a world that seems like it was just jam-packed with different gods.
Totally saturated, yeah.
And maybe the bigger question for us is, what could it possibly mean for you today, living now? It feels like a very different world.
That's exactly where we're heading in this deep dive. We're using some great source material, particularly insights from Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino on this very commandment.
Okay.
And our goal, really, is to unpack it. Understand the history for ancient Israel coming out of this, well, intensely polytheistic background.
See how their idea of God kind of grew and changed?
Yeah, how it developed. And also look at, frankly, the consequences when they didn't follow it, because they really struggle.
Well, they definitely struggle.
And then bring it forward, connect it to today, because it has this surprising relevance, you know, what things might we cling to now, maybe without even realizing it.
Okay, so how do we start wrapping our heads around just how radical this command was back then?
Well, the source gives us a great analogy right at the start. Think about building your dream house.
Okay, yeah, dream house.
You hire the absolute best specialists you can find. Foundation guys, top plumbers, the electrical wizards, expert roofers, you know, the whole crew.
Your A-team, each doing their specific thing.
Exactly. They've got their lanes, their experts. And one morning you show up and they're all gone.
Uh-oh.
And there's just this one guy there working like crazy. You ask, hey, what's going on? And he says, hi, I'm Bob. I'm doing everything now.
Everything, like the foundation, the wiring?
Everything. Designing, digging, concrete, plumbing, wiring, drywall, roof, the whole project, soup to nuts. And he claims he'll do it better, cheaper, and faster than all those specialists combined.
Okay, that sounds a little unbelievable. Maybe too good to be true.
You'd be suspicious, right? But then he shows you these amazing credentials. Seems legit. So you ask, all right, Bob, what's the catch?
Yeah, there's got to be one.
And he says, simple. Hire me. And all those other specialists. They're out. Permanently. You can't call any of them for anything. Not even to hang a picture.
Wow.
If you do, he says, our contract is void. And I'll sue you.
Whoa. That's that's intense. It's a huge leap of faith, isn't it? You have to fire your whole trusted network.
Your whole system.
And put all your trust, like 100% reliance on this one guy, Bob, for everything your dream house needs.
And that feeling right there, that captures the sheer, almost scandalous nature of the first commandment for the ancient Israelites.
Scandalous, yeah.
It demanded a kind of exclusive trust that was just totally alien to how they saw the world.
Okay, so let's dig into that world. What was the ancient context really like?
Well, think about it. Israel had spent generations in Egypt. Their ancestors came from Mesopotamia. Both places were just profoundly polytheistic. We're talking huge pantheons, hundreds, maybe thousands of gods.
Wow.
And the source material suggests it's not just likely, it's almost certain the Israelites themselves worshiped some of these gods along the way.
Right. You see hints of that.
Yeah.
Like in Joshua 24.
Exactly. Joshua challenged them. Are you going to serve the gods your ancestors served back in Mesopotamia or Egypt? Or maybe the local gods here in Canaan, like Baal? It shows this was a live issue for them.
So they were basically swimming in this sea of polytheism. It was just normal.
Completely normal. And then comes this command, okay, if you're going to be my people, my special nation, you have to ditch all those other powers. Worship me, only me.
It must have seemed, like you said, scandalous. Like being asked to put all your spiritual eggs in one basket you're just getting acquainted with.
Precisely. Imagine the uncertainty. Wait. You want us to rely on just you for rain and fertility and victory in battle and protection, everything. It was a huge ask.
Which leads to a really basic question. What did they even think a god was back then?
That's a great question. And the source points out something interesting. The Hebrew Bible itself doesn't kick off with like a neat definition. It doesn't list attributes like almighty or righteous the way later theology might.
So almighty didn't mean quite what we think?
Probably not in the same philosophical sense of like being able to do literally anything. They definitely saw God as powerful, immensely powerful. But the core idea across the ancient Near East seems simpler.
And what was that?
The common Semitic word El is basically related to power or might. That seems to be the fundamental shared attribute, power.
Okay.
And unlike, say, later Greek ideas of immortal gods, the concept of eternal existence wasn't standard outside Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Most gods were thought to be born or created somehow.
And they were often linked to nature.
Right. Absolutely. Very common.
Yeah.
You had sun gods, often linked to justice too, like Shamash, storm gods, moon gods, wind gods, deities tied to the elements.
Makes sense.
And also to life processes. Childbirth was a big one, or even negative things like plagues. They had gods associated with those too.
How were they pictured?
The source kind of describes them as supercharged humans, often like powerful kings possessing this special oomph, this power sometimes called mana, or in Egypt, Heka, which is close to magic.
And Egypt had the animal-headed gods too.
Right, that zoomorphic thing was very Egyptian. Gods as animals or human-animal hybrids.
And how did these gods supposedly feel about humans?
Huh. Well, it varied wildly. Some myths have humans created just to do the grunt work the gods didn't want to do.
Seriously?
Yeah. Then you have the Babylonian flood story, where the gods try to wipe everyone out because humans were making too much noise and they couldn't sleep.
Wow. Okay. Petty gods.
Can seem that way. But you also had gods seen as paternal or maternal figures. Or some just seemed indifferent. It was all over the map.
And this really gets back to that specialist idea, doesn't it?
Exactly. That's crucial for understanding ancient practice. You didn't just pray vaguely. You went to the expert.
Like calling tech support versus customer service.
Kind of. Need rain, pray to the storm god, need a baby, fertility goddess, going to war, war god. They each had their domain.
Few were seen as like the CEO of everything.
Very few. Marduk and Babylon maybe came close sometimes, but generally gods stayed in their lanes. You might give a nod to many gods' lip service, the source calls it, but you focused your real prayers and reliance on the one whose specialty you needed right then.
Gotcha.
And it wasn't just the big names either. The source mentions minor gods, even little imp-like figures sometimes called gods like Bez in Egypt, a dwarf god associated with fertility and protection.
And families had their own personal gods too.
Yes, absolutely. Like personal patrons or intermediaries, almost like saints and some later traditions who could intercede for you with the bigger, more powerful deities.
And these were often represented by little figures, the teraphim.
Exactly. Teraphim, it's a Hebrew plural word, interestingly, like Elohim for God, but often seems to refer to a single object or image. These were definitely seen as minor gods, sometimes even used for divination.
Like fortune telling.
Yeah, seeking guidance. Later on, prophets like Zechariah would dismiss them as nonsense, just useless idols. But the Bible itself gives examples of their use in Israel.
Like that story about Micah.
Right. Micah sets up his own little shrine, complete with an ephod, another divination tool, and these teraphim. He even installs his own son as priest. It shows how common this kind of household religion could be.
And wasn't there another story with David?
Yeah, the one where Michal, David's wife, uses a teraphim, some kind of household idol, to trick Saul's men. She puts it in the bed, covers it up, makes it look like David is sick.
Huh.
The source notes this sounds kind of silly, and it probably was meant to, but it shows these objects existed and were used.
And Rachel stealing her dad Laban's teraphim?
Mm-hmm.
And Laban calls them my gods. That's pretty direct.
Very direct. It underlines that these weren't just decorations. They were seen as holding some kind of minor divine power or connection, and they were part of Israelite life for quite a while.
Okay, so this is the world. Specialists, minor gods, household idols. It's messy. How does Yahweh, Israel's God, fit in? Or maybe stand out? Was he seen as just another specialist at first?
Well, the source suggests that at the time of Moses, the popular understanding probably wasn't full-blown monotheism yet. It was likely more like, okay, Yahweh is our God, maybe the most powerful, one God among others.
Oh, okay.
So his command wasn't just, I'm the best, it was the radical part. Worship only me, give up all the others.
Yeah.
That was the shocker.
So people might have been wondering, okay, Yahweh, so what's your specialty then?
Right. If everyone else has a job, what's yours? The source points to a couple of strong early associations. War is a big one. He's called a man of war, Yahweh Sabaoth, which means Lord of Armies.
Oh, yeah, warrior god.
And also storm imagery. Riding on the clouds, controlling the weather. Those seem like early, powerful associations.
And the descriptions could be quite human-like.
Very much so, especially early on. Talking about God's hands, his face, Moses seeing his back part. That anthropomorphic language is there. And the covenant itself sets up Yahweh as Israel's god specifically, much like Chemosh was the god of Moab, or Milcom the god of the Ammonites. Patron deities.
So did they think no other divine beings existed at all? Or just that they shouldn't worship them?
That's the million-dollar question. The source argues that clear, explicit monotheism, the belief that only one god exists, period, really comes into sharp focus later. Maybe around 500 BC, with prophets like 2nd Isaiah.
Isaiah saying, apart from me, there is no other god. That kind of thing.
Exactly. That's unambiguous monotheism. But earlier on, it seems more complicated. You have passages talking about a divine council.
Like God holding court.
Sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Or the sons of God presenting themselves before the Lord in Job. Or Psalm 82, where God judges among the Elohim, the other gods or divine beings.
So that suggests they believed other heavenly beings existed.
It strongly suggests they acknowledged other divine or spiritual entities, but Yahweh was utterly supreme, the ruler over all of them. Remember, the ancient Near East had a somewhat fuzzy line between what we might call gods, demons, angels. They were all powerful non-human beings.
So the call at Mount Sinai then was primarily for, what's the term, henotheism.
That's the term the source uses, yes. Henotheism.
Yeah.
Worshipping only one god while perhaps acknowledging others might exist. As opposed to monotheism, believing only one god exists at all.
And that henotheistic call was still completely revolutionary for its time.
Utterly. Worshipping just one deity, practically unheard of.
But beyond just demanding exclusive worship, how is Yahweh fundamentally different from those other gods?
Several key ways highlighted in the source. First, no origin story. Unlike almost all other major deities who had myths about their birth or creation, a theogony, the Bible just doesn't provide one for Yahweh. He simply is. That's a massive statement.
No beginning.
Second, and this is huge, Yahweh is presented as the creator and sustainer of everything. Not just the God of the rain or of fertility, but the source of it all. The one who made the heavens and the earth and keeps it all going.
Not just a specialist.
Yeah.
The general contractor and the architect and the owner.
Excellent analogy. Yes. Now, the source does note some scholarly discussion about exactly when this understanding became fully dominant, but the trajectory is clear, and it's a fundamental difference.
And you mentioned morality earlier.
Yes. That's the third major difference. Think about the myths of Greek or Roman or Mesopotamian gods. They could be petty, jealous, deceitful, violent. I mean, Zeus wasn't exactly a role model.
Right. Not exactly paragons of virtue.
Yet they were somehow still expected to uphold justice. It's a bit weird. But with Yahweh, his own character is the basis for morality. Be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Ethics flow from who God is.
That's a profound difference. Okay, let's look at the wording again. Before me. The Hebrew, lifni, it's a bit flexible.
It is, on its own. It could mean in my presence or in preference to me or even temporally prior to me. But the source rightly argues you have to look at the whole context, the rest of the Torah, the prophets.
And what does the wider context tell us?
It makes it pretty clear it's a ban on worshiping other gods within Israel. The idea was, among my people, in my land, there will be no other gods.
So again, maybe not denying their existence elsewhere initially, but absolutely forbidding their worship by Israel.
Exactly. Yeah. It reinforces that move towards henotheism at Sinai. Exclusive worship was the demand. Strict monotheism, denying their existence entirely, seems to crystallize later, becoming really explicit around the time of the exile and after maybe 500 BC onwards.
You mentioned Akhenaten in Egypt. He tried something similar.
He did try to elevate the sun disk, the Aten, above all other gods and suppress their worship. But scholars generally don't see it as true monotheism, partly because Akhenaten himself retained a divine status alongside the Aten. It was different from the Israelite trajectory.
Okay, so Israel gets this radical command. Worship Yahweh alone.
Yeah.
How did they actually do? Did they stick with it?
No, not really. Not consistently, anyway. The source is very clear on this. The story of Israel and Judah, as told in the historical books and prophets, is one of constant struggle with this. They were persistently drawn back to the gods of their neighbors, or tried to blend worship of Yahweh with other deities.
So the prophets complaining about idolatry weren't just exaggerating.
Not according to the source. It mentions that while some older scholarship might have downplayed the extent of popular polytheism, modern archaeology has increasingly found evidence that supports the prophetic picture. Idols, shrines to other gods. It seems to have been quite widespread at various times.
And breaking this first commandment wasn't just seen as one sin among many.
No, it was seen as the root problem. The source emphasizes this. Violating the first commandment is presented again and again as the fundamental reason for Israel's national failures, for military defeat, for the eventual exile. It's the core betrayal.
Like that vision Ezekiel has.
Yeah, Ezekiel chapter 8. It's shocking. He sees elders of Israel secretly worshiping animal idols, women weeping for a Mesopotamian god, people bowing down to the sun inside the Jerusalem temple grounds. It portrays this deep-seated syncretism and idolatry as the reason God's glory departs.
And you see it explicitly stated elsewhere too, right? Like in 1 Kings.
1 Kings 9, yeah. God warned Solomon, if you or your descendants turn away and serve other gods, that's the reason Israel will be cut off and the temple will become ruins. It specifically highlights abandoning Yahweh for other gods as the breaking point.
Not just general bad behavior, but this specific spiritual infidelity.
Exactly. It's central to the message of major prophets like Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea. They often use the metaphor of adultery. Israel is Yahweh's unfaithful wife, chasing after other lovers, other gods.
And the source connects this even to Paul in the New Testament.
Yeah, it draws a line to Romans 1, where Paul argues that humanity's fundamental error was exchanging the glory of the immortal God for images, for idols. And that wrong thinking about God, that idolatry, is presented as the root that leads to all kinds of moral decay and brokenness.
So did they ever finally get it? Did the message sink in?
It seems the Babylonian exile was the harsh medicine that finally worked for the most part. The source suggests that this persistent infatuation with foreign gods, as it calls it, largely fizzled out during that period of judgment and displacement.
So after the exile, when they came back, it wasn't the main issue anymore?
Apparently not. You look at the post-exilic prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, they're dealing with other things, rebuilding the temple, social justice, complacency, proper worship practices, but not widespread apostasy to other gods.
And later books like Chronicles compared to Kings?
Right. Chronicles tends to downplay some of the earlier apostasy. It's writing for a community that had largely moved past that particular struggle. Ezra and Nehemiah, leading the return, are concerned about intermarriage with foreigners potentially leading back to idolatry. But they don't seem to be fighting against mass worship of Baal or Asherah in their own day.
Interesting. Though maybe Jews outside the land were different.
The source notes there's more evidence for syncretism, blending religions among Jews living in diaspora. It mentions things like Jewish communities in Egypt documented in ancient letters, or even names like Esther and Mordecai, which derive from the Babylonian gods Ishtar and Marduk. It suggests assimilation pressures were stronger outside Judea.
And there was that brief, weird episode later on?
Yes, during the Hellenistic period leading up to the Maccabean Revolt. Under pressure from the Seleucid king Antiochus Epiphanes, some Jews apparently tried to identify Yahweh with the Greek god Zeus, partly for pragmatic reasons like tax benefits. The source calls it a crammed syncretistic religion, but it was forcefully rejected and didn't stick.
Okay, so that brings us towards the New Testament era, and eventually to us. How does the first commandment play out there? It's kind of surprising.
It is surprising. The source points out that the specific command, "You shall have no other gods before me," is actually never directly quoted in the New Testament.
Really? After being so central in the Old Testament?
Yeah, it's striking. Instead, what gets all the emphasis is its positive flip side.
The Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one.
Exactly, and especially the command that follows. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Jesus picks that out as the greatest commandment. It becomes the starting point, the positive foundation. The focus shifts from prohibiting others to total devotion to the one God.
Makes sense. So how did someone like Paul handle the reality of pagan gods all around the early Christians?
Paul's approach is interesting, maybe a bit nuanced. Sometimes he says, look, an idol is materially nothing, just wood or stone. Other times, he connects pagan worship practices more strongly with demonic influence.
So, kind of both hand.
Perhaps. But his consistent practical advice was clear. Christians should not participate in pagan religious rituals. Don't eat meat sacrificed to idols in the context of pagan worship. This was a huge practical issue for converts living in deeply pagan cities like Corinth or Ephesus.
Drawing a line in the sand.
Definitely. And the early church overall was remarkably steadfast on this, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They faced intense pressure, persecution, even martyrdom, often precisely because they refused to offer even a token gesture of worship to the Roman emperor or other gods. They held fast to worshiping the one God.
Okay, fast forward to today. Modern America. It's incredibly diverse religiously.
Absolutely. The source highlights this reality. We have significant populations of Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, alongside various Christian groups, Jewish communities, and this rapidly growing number of people who identify as having no religious affiliation, the Mounds.
So how does this ancient command apply now? Is it about trying to get rid of other religions?
No, and the source is really clear about this. It argues that God's mandate for Christians today isn't about trying to purge society of other beliefs through political power or coercion. History is littered with examples where trying to Christianize by force was a major misstep.
So tolerance is key.
Tolerance and respect for religious diversity in the public square are necessary. The focus of the commandment for us, the source argues, shifts inward. It's about purging our own hearts of anything that takes God's place.
And what about that idea you sometimes hear? Oh, we're all just worshiping the same God, just using different names.
Yeah, the source tackles that head on. It calls that idea baloney.
Strong word. Why?
Because, it argues, when you actually look at the core beliefs, the attributes ascribed to God, or ultimate reality, the fundamental conception of who or what is being worshipped, the path to salvation or enlightenment, they're often profoundly different. Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, they aren't just different flavors of the same thing. Their core claims about ultimate reality diverge significantly.
So how should Christians interact then? Is all interfaith dialogue bad?
Not necessarily. The source makes a distinction. Christian ecumenism, cooperation, or dialogue between different Christian groups makes sense because despite differences in practice or secondary doctrines, there's usually a shared fundamental understanding of who God is. Father, Son, Holy Spirit, the God revealed in Jesus Christ.
Okay. But what about interacting with completely different religions?
There, the source advises caution regarding participation in worship. It says, engaging in the religious rituals of traditions that do not worship the same God, say, joining prayers in a mosque or chanting in a Buddhist temple risks compromising that first commandment principle of exclusive worship.
So be a respectful observer, learn, build relationships.
Absolutely. Be humble guests, learn from neighbors, show respect, but draw a line at actively participating in worship directed towards a different deity or ultimate reality. That maintains integrity to the core command.
Okay, this brings us right to the heart of it for us personally today. You mentioned the ancient idea of a god being about power and reliance.
Yes. And that leads directly to Martin Luther's really insightful definition centuries later, which the source highlights. Luther said, whatever your heart clings to and relies on, that is your god.
Wow. Say that again.
Whatever your heart clings to and relies on, that is your god. Notice it's not just about what you love most or think about most. It's about trust, reliance. Where do you put your ultimate weight? What's your bottom line for security, hope, meaning?
That totally reframes it for today, doesn't it? It's not about statues in the ancient sense.
And I usually know. It's about these functional gods, these things or concepts that we treat as if they have ultimate power or can provide ultimate security.
So what are some examples the source gives of these modern fake gods that we might cling to?
It lists several thought-provoking ones, things like maybe hoping aliens will show up and save us from ourselves. Sounds sci-fi, but it reflects a kind of externalized hope.
Okay.
More commonly, the almighty dollar, relying on money and wealth for ultimate security and meaning, or placing almost godlike faith in the government to fix all our problems.
See that a lot.
Or expecting science to solve everything, hunger, war, injustice, mortality. The source is careful here. It deeply values science. But it warns against making science the ultimate source of salvation or reliance because it has limits. It can't answer every question or meet every need.
What else?
Even clinging to other people in unhealthy, codependent ways. Expecting another human being to be your ultimate source of identity, worth, or fulfillment, essentially making them your God.
These are things we might look to, maybe unconsciously, for what only God can truly provide. Safety, purpose, hope.
Exactly. They become idols not because they're inherently evil, but because we give them a place in our hearts, a weight of reliance that they simply cannot bear.
And why can't they bear it? Why are they inadequate as gods?
Because, as the source points out, none of them have the actual power, the ultimate authority, the scope, the wisdom, the love, the sheer capacity to meet our deepest, most fundamental needs across the board. Money fails. Governments are flawed. Science has limits. People disappoint. They might be helpful tools or good gifts in their proper place, but they make terrible gods.
Only the actual creator and sustainer has that kind of comprehensive ability.
That's the claim. Only the God described in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the source argues, has the power and the character to be worthy of that ultimate trust and reliance.
So the challenge of the first commandment today boils down to a really searching, personal question for everyone listening.
Yes. It comes back to Luther's definition and the question the source leaves us with. What is it, really, that your heart clings to? What are you truly relying upon deep down? Who or what have you actually made your God?
And connecting back to Jesus calling the Shema the greatest commandment, loving God with everything.
Right. If you love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, if your ultimate reliance and trust are placed there, then theoretically there's just no room left for these other functional gods, these idols, to take root in that central place in your life.
Wow. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. From ancient polytheism, this radical call to Israel, their struggles, the exile, the shift in focus in the New Testament,
all the way to this surprisingly relevant challenge for us today. It's not about ancient statues so much anymore.
It's about identifying what truly holds that place of ultimate reliance and trust in our own hearts. Where do we really turn? What do we really cling to for security and hope?
It's a profound question. Maybe think about those modern potential gods. We talked about money, approval, control, technology, even a political ideology. When you feel stressed or scared or uncertain about the future, where does your mind instinctively go first? What do you find yourself trying to shore up or control?
That instinct might reveal more than we think about where our true trust lies. Something important to reflect on.